Welcome to the G Word, the podcast from Genomics England. My name is Anna Tomlinson. I'm the Chief Communications and Engagement Officer here at Genomics England. And today I'm delighted to be joined by Augusto Rendon, who is our Chief Bioinformatician. Augusto has a plethora of PhDs and phenomenal intellect. He's been with Genomics England now for 7 years and has also spent a lot of time at the University of Cambridge as a research scientist. Augusto, great to see you today. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you do here at Genomics England?
Yes, of course. Great to be here, Anna. What do I do at Genomics England? So these days, I look after about 50 plus bioinformaticians and what we call genomic data scientists. And I see my role as trying to nurture them to be the best they can as they work within our organization and our other stakeholders.
Today, we're going to be talking a bit more about bioinformatics, as I'm not a scientist myself. And when I joined Genomics England a couple of years ago, it took me a while to learn how to say bioinformatician, let alone know what you did. So for the other people like me who are out there, could you tell us a little bit more about what bioinformatics is and how that fits into what we're trying to do here at Genomics England?
Sure. It's kind of a very broad field, and I often also struggle with the answer to that question. So perhaps I think that the best answer I can give you is there's a mix of things that go into being a bioinformatician. So people will know lots about computers. They will know about biological data. They will throw in a handful of maths and science and engineering, and then you kind of shake it all around. And then you're primarily trying to use these various methods to understand biological data.
And how does that fit into the world of genomics as we work here at Genomics England and also across the NHS? So how do we use those skills and that information?
Yeah, so indeed, there's many classes, I was saying, of bioinformatics, and it depends very much on the problem. So we focus on looking at DNA, at the genome itself. And what we try to do is look at that genome and try to understand from that something about the disease, how it progresses, what we can say about diagnosis or treatment. And other people, for example, will worry about how proteins are formed and so on. But ours is very much around the DNA. And perhaps the second aspect of that, much more tied to engineering, is how do you manage very large amounts of data, in this case, sequencing data, and extract those insights from it.
I know certainly with the human genome, you've got many, many different pieces of data there to look at. How do you start looking at that? Is it broken down into separate pieces? Do we use AI, machine learning? How do you go about breaking down such a huge amount of data?
Yeah, so it all starts in kind of the modern sequencing technologies that have been around for over a decade now. You start with reads. They are essentially sentences of about 150 letters written in ACTG. And what our role is, you have these sentences, and those sentences come from a genome, and you want to put them back in the right order within that genome and find where the spelling mistakes are. So that is our goal, and that typically comes from having billions of those letters that you want to put onto the 3 or so billion letters that our genomes are. So we tend to have, say, 30 times more letters, and we put them over that and try to find the differences. And so what type of algorithms we use? The tool chains, the algorithms have been evolving for a long time now. It started from the old days when you were trying to do the human genome, where you had slightly longer reads, or much longer reads, and you were trying to put them together, what used to be called shotgun sequencing. And so since then, lots of algorithms have been developed. Nowadays, that continues to evolve. And yes, we could call it machine learning methods. There are a variety of statistical and computational approaches that are often quite optimized. These days, we also use things like hardware acceleration, which is special types of computers where the algorithm is coded into the hardware and it can be changed to accelerate some of those processes.
Fascinating. I'd like to come back in a little while to talk about how that actually fits into healthcare and how that translates into how we're working with the NHS. But first of all, I'm really interested to know how you got here. So I know you were a research scientist by background, and I know you joined Genomics England at the start of the 100,000 Genomes Project, or certainly very, very close to the start of that. When did you jump from research scientist to genomics? Was that at Cambridge? And so where was your learning there?
Yeah, I can definitely tell you about it. I'm actually originally a physicist. I'm Colombian, and I did my physics degree in Colombia. And I remember quite well since then, I've been quite passionate about biological processes, biological problems. So I've been doing a transition from physics to biology. And I moved to Cambridge to do a postdoc in William Owen's lab, looking at how platelets and more generally blood is formed. And we used a variety of statistical and experimental approaches in using primarily genomics to identify those mechanisms of blood formation and platelet function. And that's where it really started. And what I would say is towards the end of my time in Willem's lab, we started a large project, which became the NIHR BioResource for Rare Disorders, now about 10,000 patients, that was looking at identifying people with rare inherited disorders that affected blood and platelets, and then it expanded to other conditions. And it was a natural way of trying to understand the genetics and how blood is formed from a genetic mechanism, but also, of course, a way of helping patients find diagnosis. And that I was helping that from both setting up the experimental side. We started initially with panels and exomes, whole genomes as part of that evolution, and also from the bioinformatics approaches. It was quite a natural transition to jump from, let's say, using genetics to identify biological principles to then using genetics for diagnostics and then scaling that up, which is when I joined GEL.
That's fascinating. And certainly I did science up to A level and have always been slightly upset that I didn't go on to do medicine after that. So I'm one of those wannabe doctors who's actually fascinated by healthcare, which is why I find myself here. So to actually see how this comes together now and how genomics is starting to have an impact on healthcare from my layman perspective is fascinating. And I can see how you've transitioned through the sciences and have also migrated towards the healthcare side as well. So perhaps we can talk a little bit about that and how what you do now impacts on our work here at Genomics England. So everybody knows our background here is 100,000, and now we're moving forwards to becoming a more sustainable company where we're sequencing a lot more genomes to facilitate research and to find more diagnoses and treatments for different diseases and many other projects as well that we're working on at the moment. How does bioinformatics fit into that in terms of the real world outcomes? So are we optimistic that this can help people in the future and improve health of nations?
So let me maybe tease apart some of those questions. Let's start with how does bioinformatics fit in this? So within the wider framework of personalized medicine, trying to identify treatments, diagnosis, prognosis that is about an individual, rather than, and that is personalized to that individual. Genomics plays a really important role because our genomes are unique. And so bioinformatics is there to try to identify how those genomes are unique and what do they tell us about the consequences of those differences. And so, yes, our role there is the standard sort of thing we do in bioinformatics in this space is we would take those reads that I was talking about earlier, and then we identify the variants, and then we try to find as much information as we can about the meaning of those variants. How do they affect the function of the cells and organisms? And then we translate that either into a diagnosis, or in the case of, for example, cancer, we try to also identify, well, given these mutations, what is the natural course of that disease, something around prognosis, or what therapies are available, given that people carry these different mutations. So that's, in a nutshell, what we do. We identify, in the rare diseases cases, variants that are likely to explain that condition, and ideally, in some cases, also where there is a treatment. And then in the cancer side, is more finding insights that the variants in the tumor, but also in the person's constitutional DNA, their germline DNA, can tell us something about how their cancer arises and progresses. So that's kind of in the specifics. In the general sense of how it helps medicine, well, it's definitely genetic disorders. There are many of them and they're rare, but together there are lots of them. And that brings an interesting problem of complexity where you have to be able to tackle many different types of conditions, yet together, once you tackle them, you can make an impact.
That's amazing. And we certainly work very closely with NHS England here at Genomics England as well. How do we pass this information back to NHS England? Because we're obviously fine, we have huge amounts of data, as I explain it to people as putting a blood sample into a photocopier and it spits out lots of letters at the other end, which the clever people like yourself, Augusto, deal with all this data. How do we then get that back to the NHS and actually back to benefit the patient?
Yes, this is an area where we at Genomics England have a slightly different arrangement than, say, many other places, many other projects in the world, and more traditionally, clinical genetics labs have. So what we do is we take those genomes, those large amounts of data, just to put it into context, a genome is somewhere between, depending on how you compress it, between, say, 30 gigabytes and 200 gigabytes. Nowadays, that's roughly what you can store in a phone, depending on what phone you have. And so we take those amounts of data and we produce a series of analyses. So we use various algorithms, knowledge sources, knowledge that we've accumulated through the processing of previous participants and patients. And we provide the NHS a set of candidates, as well as the totality of the data, and say, look, here are some things that are worthwhile for you looking into, spending some time in a lab saying, I think this might be the diagnostic case. We call that interpretation. So and then they go ahead and create, say, a report that goes on to be used in the management and diagnosis of that patient. So we are there to, in many ways, leverage and enable those labs rather than to do their work. I think that's quite different to other places where this is quite integrated. That step is integrated and is recognizing the scale of the challenge, I think, that we're able to help with that.
Absolutely. And it's a huge leap, certainly going to almost transforming healthcare to a totally different level where we're able to predict illnesses that might occur and personalized medicine on the back of that as well. So I can imagine how that flip is not going to happen overnight. So a huge job ahead. So, Augusto, can you tell us, what have we actually built here?
I would start by saying that we've taken a lot of the inspiration for what we've built from things that already existed. And I think our potential claim to fame, if any, would be that we've made it work at scale. So, and perhaps the other caveat or thing I should mention is that it's been the work of a lot of people. What I would like to perhaps focus on a few examples. The more trivial thing that we've done, and this will sound strange, is to be able to sequence 100,000 genomes and be able to do that all the time. So a lot of people actually have pipelines that sequence hundreds of thousands of people. It's almost a question of time and effort and money. So that we were able to do and scale it, and we constantly work on making that better, faster, more accurate, more cost-effective, more stable, so that we can provide a better clinical service. Perhaps what's behind that is the amount of work that has gone into making it really high quality with very good analytical performance. So a lot of our team is actually working on what variants can I call? Can I call more classes of variants? And then how well do I know that I'm trying, that I have a very good performance on that so that I can call them with very high sensitivity and specificity. We actually need to do that in partnership with the labs in the NHS very closely because they are the ones that have the truth sets. And so we often exchange truth sets with them and then we try to make the genomes or analyzing the genomes to recapitulate what those standards of care look like. And we spend truly a lot of effort in this and we're proud of that. The second thing that we do is trying to distill in a let's say digestible way the hundreds of variants for which you can say something, that you can make up a story about why it's meaningful, why is it diagnostic, or why it informs cancer, and present it in a number of classes and scores, and essentially prioritize them and classify them such that the labs are not overwhelmed by that, and that we can maintain some quality on the, on those results. And so when we started the program, there was huge worries about us returning back to the labs hundreds of variants. What are they going to do? And at the time, we were very conservative in our approach. We learned a lot from existing projects, such as the Deciphering Developmental Disorders, where they have set out different rules to how to look at those, in this, in their case, exomes. And so a lot of what we do, perhaps to summarize that, is how you analyze genomes to have some classification, some prioritization of variants, not to overwhelm the labs, while being able to maintain some diagnostic rates, so to make sure that we are trying to diagnose as many people, get as much actionable content. And it is a difficult balance that we're learning all the time about making better. We have developed a few algorithms and we've implemented others. Another one which I didn't anticipate at the time that would be successful, and certainly as successful as it has been, is what we call PanelApp. PanelApp started from a problem, or a number of problems. The first one was there was a lot of inconsistency across the world as to what genes cause what disorders, and there were lots of gene lists going around. The second one was, how do you manage these gene lists? How do you manage lots of spreadsheets in a kind of consistent way? And the third one is, how do you curate? How do you create this gene list across many, many conditions and ensure you have good knowledge going into that when that requires so much effort? We have, you know, nowadays more than 200 different conditions for which we have gene lists. And what we used to solve that, to both help our teams create some harmonization and deal with the spreadsheet problem, was this application called PanelApp, which is essentially a way of crowdsourcing knowledge and having in a single place a way of saying, this is what the community thinks are the genes that are involved in causing a particular condition. And it became very, very popular, and it's used across many places in the world. We get millions of hits asking across the world. It's now accredited for use in clinical practice. There's even a standalone version that is used in the NHS to define what are the genes associated with specific conditions they have in their test directory. We have sister projects, for example, in Australia, with which we share information. So that was perhaps unexpected, but it was a problem that existed, and I think we had a good balanced approach to solving. I think perhaps the one that I'm most proud of, and again, it wasn't our idea, it existed in other places, is what we call the clinical variant arc. And that is a place where we, in many ways, passively, by that I mean without having to type in information, we capture information from our analysis systems, but also from what the clinical labs, what we call here the genomic laboratory hubs, enter as they are interpreting a patient. So they would say, I think this variant is pathogenic, it's causing the disorder for this reason, here's this evidence. And as they're typing that into the systems that generate the reports, we also capture that data, we manage it, and we also make it available back to them so that a lab in, say, Exeter can see what variants were being entered or had been potentially diagnostic in, say, Liverpool. And so across the entire NHS, they can exchange that knowledge and help diagnose patients. So those ideas existed, the Cypher, there are many other systems, and the idea of also capturing automatically existed. I think the big thing for us was to be able to do that for the whole of the country. And we hope to, at some point, and that's our next challenge, to also make that data available with consent and all of that internationally to help the various patient communities across the world. Because, you know, these diseases are rare. Even in the cancer setting, there are many, many variants. So coming with sufficient information across any single event needs a whole world effort.
There are a few other things that I know that you've been involved in. You wrote a blog for our 8th birthday this year, where you mentioned how we leverage the cloud in our COVID study. The cloud is obviously a big thing for everything genomics and beyond. Is that something that's facilitating the work that we do? Can we expect the technology to help from a, certainly from a bioinformatics perspective as well going forwards?
If you don't mind, I would love to tell you a bit about kind of our experience in Genomics England with the cloud and why it's important. And perhaps let's start with there. Why it's important. So this is more for the techies out there, but if we look at how we used to do, say, software that required lots of computers, we would have to buy the computers, we would have to install those computers, we would have to manage them, then create software, redeploy the software when it needed to be changed, create new types of, say, databases to store some of these data, had to manage all of that. And if you were running out of compute, you would have to very carefully manage projections about your budgets and how much more you wanted to buy and how much was going to be used. The cloud completely turned that upside down and said, you don't have to worry about any of that. You can just go to the cloud, use the machines you need. You can very easily, let's call it, instantiate what we used to have to purchase, use it, and when you're finished, you dispose of it. You essentially stop paying for it. And more recently, there's been a huge amount of what we call cloud services, different types of databases, services that process data, transform data, manage data, that in the past you would have to stand up all by yourself. Now, if you know how to use the cloud, you can invoke all of that simply by using code. So that has really transformed the world, and we are in some ways in bioinformatics a little bit behind the curve in that. Depending on where you sit in comparison to other industries. And so how are we using it now? So one of the key aspects is about being able to match the demand or the number of genomes that are flowing through the system, the number of tests that we're processing. Instead of having to have lots of compute available, as I described before, you can simply be elastic in the cloud and say, I want today 1,000 machines, tomorrow I only need 100. And being able to optimize for various, for that is really helpful. And that's been going on in bioinformatics for say 5 years. And just everyone is now coming to that. The other aspect of this, which is the second part of that, of what we do in Genomics England, is the research aspect. And that's where we've made a big step forward in the last year, where we benefited from, I almost feel bad saying this, but from the COVID pandemic, where we were asked, look, can we sequence humans that have had COVID, either in severe situations or very mild COVID, so we can try to understand the genetics of that? And can we take those data and make them available to the community as fast as possible? And as part of that, working with, we did that with our collaborators in Edinburgh from the Genomic Institute, the Genomic Study. And as part of that, we stood up a completely cloud-native research environment where we put the data, we put tools, and we completely leverage that cloud to make it easy for everyone. So the sorts of things that enables you is to, as I was saying, be elastic. If you need more compute, you can put in more compute. But it also means that if you want to bring data from other places, you don't have to copy it over. You can, because these are all like made for the internet. You can simply say, my data is in this little bucket somewhere there. I just wanted to make it available within this environment where I have the rest of the COVID data, for example. So those are some elements of federation that you can bring in. Same can be done about code. The other aspect to this is the security. One of the things that we've been concerned, or people are concerned about, is the security of the cloud. And sure, you need to know what you're doing in the cloud to be able to make it secure. But it is by far much more well, it's much better understood. There's very good practices, very good controls, even all the way to constantly monitoring your security. So a lot of the work we've been doing is how do you deploy those platforms to do research in a very secure way, such that patients' data is maintained according to the consent and the expectations from the patients and the public. Yeah, so that's what our migration to the cloud has been. Compare that with having to manage your own high-performance computing cluster, making sure that you're updating all the right patches so that you cannot get hacked and those sorts of things. It's a very different scale. And we're loving it. It's made so much progress. It's really helping people. And definitely the future. There are many other platforms like that nowadays. The thing for us, though, as bioinformaticians, is that we, depending on how old you've been in the field, you might have been more used to more traditional things like high-performance computing, even sometimes just your desktop under your table. And working in the cloud is a paradigm shift. And so the types of tools that you're familiar with, the way you interact with the data changes. And so there is a change in skills that we are all going through as, say, practitioners in this field.
That's fascinating. Certainly a huge amount that I didn't know there, even after a couple of years here in the organization. So just one other question there on data privacy or data security, because clearly that's a major concern for a lot of people where genomics comes into play within healthcare. The data is anonymized. I know when it leaves the patient and it comes through to us into our systems. How do we ensure that, first of all, anybody who is researching on our data can't identify patients? And then on the flip side of that, how do we make sure that the patient is getting the right findings back that is actually aligned to their records and their name and their date of birth? Where do we strip that out?
Let me perhaps tell you a little bit about how the kind of full data flow looks like. So we actually don't talk about anonymizing, we talk about de-identifying, because we do in Genomics England hold the identifiers for the 100,000 Genomes Project. And in the Genomic Medicine Service, we also hold information that is identifiable. But what we do is we have two very different, almost universes to what we do. We have our, let's say, clinical systems, and we have our research systems. And from the clinical systems, where all the information is potentially identifiable, and we actually try to put very strict limits on what systems actually need to have identifiers. So to give you an example, none of the bioinformatics systems carry personal identifiable information. They all have IDs that match the original patients, but those personal identifiable IDs are kept in very few systems. And then when we take those data into the research environments, we take special care that there are no identifiers that can go back to the patient. That's what we call the identification. We remove them, so there won't be any full postcodes or NHS numbers, names, dates of, full dates of births. Those things won't appear at the other side. Then we put an additional layer of control, which is not uncommon when you're talking about financial and administrative data for research purposes, but it's more uncommon when you look at genomics. And that is, we have had since the beginning this concept of a reading library, which is that you can come to the data, you can look at it all, and by that I mean the de-identified data, but you can only take out summary statistics, and we have a process to do that. We call it the airlock, where when people are taking out things, they only are able to take summaries so that they are not directly identifying an individual or can risk the identification of an individual. That is, of course, a process that is an additional barrier. And so researchers might find that difficult. I would hope patients find that a good thing to have. And there is a kind of a whole dialogue as a society of where is the right level. It has worked for us. The other part to this is the fact that I do want to make clear that it is not completely impossible to re-identify a person. So we know from lots of studies that given the type of data we have, their genomes, clinical data, if you try very hard and you perhaps use additional sources of information, you could go ahead and take it down to who's carrying that, whose data that is. And of course, we ask people to sign a paper that says they won't do that. But it doesn't mean that once you go through the approval to access the data, we make sure that you're part of a real organization and you have a research project, but we cannot necessarily control all the things they do in terms of looking at the data. That would be just too big a barrier to get any research out of it. So we try really hard to avoid that, but it is a possibility.
That's really interesting. So there is so much data flying around, and certainly I was surprised how big one genome is, let alone how much we're holding now. And now we're cracking well over the 100,000 marks. So that's really interesting. Thank you, Augusta. Just a couple of things as we reach the end of our conversation today that on a more personal level that I'd be really interested to know. As you've been through the 100,000 genome project and we're moving on now, what are the most memorable moments that you've had over the past few years here at Genomics England?
It's hard. You know, there's been long nights with the team trying to make things happen, and those tend to be quite memorable, and team building and so on. Maybe if I can go around the question somehow, perhaps in contrast to other experiences that I've had in my life, primarily in academia, it has been the opportunity to work with really high caliber people from many different disciplines. People like yourself, Anna, that come from a universe, again, that I would have just very rarely interacted with, and being able to see how people think about problems, what they can contribute, and that whole element of, let's say, multidisciplinarity and so on. So for me, that's been great. Working with people that come from the software and informatics side, people that work from commercial communications, also from digital skills such as user research, even dare I say consultants that just bring a really crisp way of thinking about problems and how to share them. So that has really helped me grow personally and professionally. I really appreciate that opportunity. Actually, that's one of my it's probably my most memorable take home message from having worked at GEL.
I'd actually have to agree with that completely, but from the other side of the fence, that I've never worked so closely with so many highly qualified academics and who are so deeply embedded in the science. And it's been a real learning curve for me as to how much is out there and how much we know and how much we've still got to learn. So I've learned a huge amount from people like yourself, Augusto. So I certainly agree with that point, that it's a great experience to see across the board. And my last question for you today is, if you were in the hot seat, who would you want to have a conversation with and why?
It's a difficult one because, you know, there's lots of people I have like my heroes in the genomic space. But I think for this, I would love to have a conversation with the future chief exec of the NHS, whoever he or she is. And the reason is, you know, I think what I've learned over the years personally, and of course is something that we all know as a society, is great to be able to take the science and bring it translated to the bench side. And so I would love to be able to explore with them the role of genomics in medicine and, you know, how we can help with genomics make patients' lives better, but also how we can make the healthcare system work better. It is not easy because, you know, on one side, we have this huge explosion on genomics, at least from where I stand, and what you can do with it, how easy it is, how affordable it is. And on the other side, we're seeing all these huge pressures on healthcare systems. And so I do worry in my kind of constant anxiety too, that it is very easy to default on what's urgent and perhaps do that at the expense of a better future. So I would love a conversation on like, how can we accelerate something? How we can perhaps not forget about other things, trying to solve more urgent problems.
That's great. Thanks, Augusto. Well, I've certainly learned a huge amount in the last 30 minutes. So I work here at a very high level in terms of detail, but to actually understand the nuts and bolts of what goes into the outputs and the projects that we're working on every day is fascinating. So really appreciate your time, Augusto. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to work with you, and we will no doubt be hearing much more from you in the future. So thanks again, Augusto.
Really my pleasure, and thanks for sharing this time with me here. It was really fun.
Well, that's all for this episode. Thank you for listening to this discussion and for joining us on the journey to highlight and debate the implications of genomics as it comes to the mainstream of healthcare and society. Remember to subscribe to the G Word on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. If you have views on these topics, or if you have a suggestion for someone we should interview, then please do write to us at podcast@genomicsengland.co.uk. And if you've enjoyed listening, we'd really appreciate a 5-star review, as this helps other people to find out about the series too. I've been Anna Tomlinson. and we look forward to seeing you on the next episode.